Welcome to the Command Line Podcast. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. Sorry to have missed you on the mic last week. I wish I had some specific reason for it. Really, my weekend just kind of got away from me and wasn't able to sit down and record. As always, if you're interested in my commentary on news stories throughout the week, I encourage you to follow my feed reader's public feed. There's always a link to that in the show notes every episode that goes out. Definitely includes everything that I talk about on any given episode for the week, and usually quite a bit more. Obviously not to the same depth, but same kinds of observations, same kinds of continuing themes. Also, just a quick note that I'll be traveling next week, so unfortunately will have reason to miss next week's episode. Anyway, to start off with, I wanted to talk about this T-Mobile binge on story. I didn't get a chance to talk about EFF's original investigation that kicked this all off. This reminded me really strongly of the time that I spent supporting the project Measurement Lab. There's an interesting aspect of certain communications technologies. Companies can make whatever claims they want about how they behave, what value you're getting for dollars spent. But the fact that we are participants with those technologies, the fact that we have to touch them and have access to many of the moving parts of them, means that they are objectively auditable. You can dicker about methodology, especially when it comes to bandwidth or other aspects, but really, we can form a very direct observational sense of how these tools work. So when a company comes in and makes a bullshitty claim, it's not surprising that an activist group, a nonprofit, or academics, in this case EFF, or in years past in a former life, projects like Measurement Lab, step in to call them on it. That's definitely what EFF did here. They looked at exactly what it was that T-Mobile's doing on the network to the videos that are being provided through the binge on offer. And as it turns out, effectively, according to their descriptions, T-Mobile is throttling their users, and they're selling it as a benefit. Now, to be fair to T-Mobile, there is something to their rhetoric about in response to this, that on a smaller screen, you don't need the resolution. You don't need all of the video that you might need on your 60-inch television. But the fact that they're not clear, they're not transparent to the consumer about what they're actually doing, and even worse, what EFF found is third parties who had not opted into binge on had their videos throttled as well. The story doesn't end there. T-Mobile's CEO took to video to respond to this investigation, making some pretty inaccurate claims about what was going on, pushing back not on any objective basis, not with facts, but really with a lot of hot air, and got a lot of people understandably very worked up over social media, not in the least because he asked, who is EFF? Who are these people? Why are they doing this? This is kind of surprising in this space that he would not have at least some passing knowledge of who EFF is, what their role is in defending our rights online, and the limited work that they've done. They don't normally focus on consumer issues quite this directly, but here when we're talking about access to communication, it strongly overlaps with a lot of the other issues that they track and care about. Some of the best coverage and explanation of the back and forth around this over the last week and a half is from Mike Masnick and the crew at TechDirt. I'll include several links to their breakdowns, as usual, very highly readable, about the claims that T-Mobile's making and even is contradicting depending on who you talk to, whether it's the CEO or they've also talked to a spokesperson who actually admitted, yes, we do throttle what EFF found, in fact, is pretty accurate to how the service actually works. I leave it to you to kind of tease this together. I do think that the burden really is on the ISPs to make clear what they're doing, to make it clear to inform consumer choice. what is involved with offers of this kind, especially things that touch on what I've talked about in the past and other stories as problematic, as a slippery slope when we get into zero rating of services online, this really horrible loophole around otherwise neutral network operation. One of the stories that I will link to, the CEO did admit that he will sit down and talk to EFF. I've not seen any follow-up on that, whether they've had any actual conversation. But given his reactions, especially given how high-flown and emotional they've been, I'm not really sure I'm very optimistic that there'll be a true meeting of the minds here versus the kind of thing that we normally see with these companies where they go through the motions of engaging with public interest groups and come away saying that they have served the public interest in some way, when they really haven't. They think that they should get a trophy, a prize, for just showing up. I've become increasingly aware of coding boot camps. They, in my experience, really kind of came out of the civic hacking space as a way to kind of get people who are motivated to program for reasons other than just the joy of programming up to speed to work with data or tooling in some way that serves a community or serves broader interest. They apparently have also started to serve much more pedestrian ends or more commercial ends. I've heard a lot of advertising on podcasts of Code School and others that are much more focused on recruiting into industry, into feeding the private sector. I liken it to my experience back in the 90s during the original bubble that I worked through as the trend of increasingly thick tech books with titles along the formula of learn such and such hot technology in so many weeks, days, or hours. I'll grant that the boot camps pedagogically are probably a bit more sustainable in one sense than those books are, that there probably are some that are staffed by people who really care about attendees, about them entering into fulfilling careers, retooling to take on this very exciting, still exciting, trend of expanding technology, especially communications and network technology like web applications and the like. Issy Lepowski on Wired has an interesting piece, though, that suggests that this bootcamp bubble is going to burst at some point. This is worth a read, given the proliferation of these training programs. It also kind of ties the through line with what I was talking about at the outset of these coding programs for more civic-minded goals. Maybe this will contract back to that. I think that caution is warranted. Read the piece if you're interested. If you have experience of this or you've been thinking about entering into one of these programs in order to accelerate your career, it's probably worth understanding how these boot camps actually interact with market demand. And they may actually, I think the suggestion here is that they just may be a bit inflated. I think that that was definitely the case with other kinds of resources that I remember, again, from my experience of 10 plus years ago with the kind of crazy demands then, which we're seeing in many ways come back around now for technological talent. Speaking of technology adoption, it is nice to see people considering other reasons to adopt, to look at technologies that are not maybe as yoked to mainstream drivers like these coding boot camps. A great example is a Medium article by journalist Dan Gilmore talking about his recent experiences moving to Linux. This is a topic that I've unpacked repeatedly over the years. I haven't talked about recently, with my own move away from and then back to and even a stronger rededication to Linux, not just for the technology and the attractiveness of the engineering, admittedly that is a draw for me as a technologist my own self, but for the freedoms that it affords me in terms of choice of tools, ownership of data. Dan does a great job of explaining all of that in a way that anybody could understand. He also lays out some of the challenges for a non-technologist to truly break away from some very sticky technologies, especially services like Google. I'll admit that I have done a little better than I think he accounts for in his article, but only, again, because I am an experienced technologist. I can stand up my own virtual servers and dig into not always the most readable and user-friendly documentation to get alternatives up and running. I encourage you, if you're curious, if you have followed the conversation on this podcast or similar conversations elsewhere about the move to more free and open technologies, to check this out and give it a read. It's well worth your time. Just as tech hiring trends come back around, boom and bust cycles come back around in the realm of technology, it seems like the crypto wars from a couple of decades ago are coming back around, as I've talked about, spurred by the revelations of Edward Snowden and others about the overreach of law enforcers when it comes to mass online surveillance. It's not surprising that the space of tools responding to that and trying to provide some assurances to end users in terms of their security and privacy online are increasing and heating up. The latest in this vein also seems to be trying to speak to those law enforcers to provide a compromise that admittedly is pretty uncomfortable. This is an offering by Professor David Chalm, who actually is responsible for some of the earliest anonymization technology, mixing. I remember many years ago being on a Cypherpunk's mailing list that used a Mixmaster. This was an implementation of Chalm's idea. In a nutshell, if I can describe this correctly, I'm sure someone will call me out if I get it wrong, by mixing together your messages and having multiple servers that pass these mixes around, it makes it much harder than with standard email to tease back where a message originated, providing stronger assurances of some kinds of anonymity. In those original mixing systems, the number of servers that participated was open-ended. At the height, quite a few of them were involved, making it a nightmare, even if it was possible, to apply the computation power and manpower to trace a message back to its author. He seems to have thought better of this. I'm not entirely sure why, that a more maintainable system, what's talked about in this article, this Wired article by Andy Greenberg that I'll link to, actually nets it down to 9 servers, but with a multi-part key split across those servers. And this is where it gets problematic for me with this. Not just that it's centralized, so rather than through an open-ended set of servers, through these blessed servers, but with those keys, a law enforcer actually can decrypt and uncover authors of communications. And that's where this compromise notion gets in. I credit his intentions, but I worry that this just feeds into the perception by law enforcers that lawful intercept is okay, and that really it also feeds into the trend that they're never satisfied because they think it's a silver bullet being able to uncover secure communications. And it's not. It's not a substitute for good, solid investigatory practices and really leveraging all of the resources, not just technological, to prosecute an investigation into criminal activities, into bad action online. It is early days yet. By his own admission, he doesn't have a full system up and running. So we'll just see in practice whether this is going to be subject to the kind of pressure that I worry that it is, being so centralized. And if it's going to, not necessarily as intended, shift the tenor of the debate, the contour of this discussion about online security, but rather feed into the, I think, worst instincts of law enforcers as participants in that conversation. Another throwback to earlier eras of computing with which I've got personal firsthand experience is the Newton. If you don't recall, if you didn't encounter this Apple device's precursor of today's smartphones and smart devices, it was arguably one of the first palm-sized tablets. It had built-in handwriting recognition, a grayscale screen with, I don't remember if it was 256 shades or 64 shades or something like that. It was not super impressive, but it was pretty good contrast, pretty workable. It still has a very dedicated community, and I've linked to in the show notes a posting from someone who still carries a Newton, who sums up both some of the original draw of this device, that not just its engineered aspects, the obvious ones like the screen I described, the handwriting recognition, but the way that it organized information and the way that it actually in many ways works much closer to note-taking on paper makes it still superior in many ways, and I tend to agree with the argument, to the devices that we have today, at least in terms of keeping people participating in conversations rather than using their gadgets to opt out and distract themselves from conversations. Well worth a read, even if you don't know about the Newton. He does kind of give you some insights into its history, the ongoing community that's still actually very enthused about this device and has managed to bring a lot of modern capabilities, surprisingly, like being able to attach wirelessly to the modern internet to it to keep it viable and allow people to continue to pursue their passion for it. By and large, I've skipped over coverage of the Consumer Electronics Show, which pretty much takes over the usual tech news outlets the early part of January. There's one story that actually did kind of catch my attention that looked like a lot of fun. It reminded me of my teenage years playing laser tag. This is a project called the Supersuit. I'll include a link to, I think it's a Wired article. By Brian Barrett. What's neat about this, other than kind of the goofiness and the nostalgia factor, is it will have an open SDK. So beyond just kind of the tag games or kind of similar obvious ways that you could play with this, you could come up with any number of field games. And rather than necessarily having to have specialized equipment or be super creative with limited tooling, you could use this much more sort of general purpose kit to do all kinds of fun stuff, come up with variations for team-on-team play, innovative things, and have that at an interesting intersection where kids, families, schools could both pursue good physical activity like that, good inventive play, but also the creativity and the skills acquisition, the learning, going into figuring out how to actually program those games. So go ahead and check that out if you find that in any way as fascinating as I do. To wrap up, I've got two links to works from Cory Doctorow. The first is a really thought-provoking article about the role of resilience in computing. This is one of Cory's usual great think pieces where he's talking about just the kinds of models, especially coming out of radio regulation, what the FCC traditionally has done, of trying to exert centralized control on these systems and how that fails. And it leads to any number of problems that he itemizes really well. In response to that, he proposes something that I've encountered in other areas of research and reading as well, to use both ubiquitous computing, cheap ubiquitous computing, coupled together with sensing. The idea is that you could then, as I think he puts it most powerfully, distribute and decentralize accountability systems for things like smart cars and smart radios, so that it wouldn't be incumbent on a centralized agency to try to anticipate all of the safety problems that are impossible, that they're just going to naturally be failures of imagination when it comes to thinking about that, but rather leverage that crowd intelligence, that smart of having any number of devices out there that could uncover things like, I think what he implicates here, the VW cheating on emissions testing, that if you've got thousands of sensors around that, a lot harder to get away with that, that the environment becomes smart enough to help really truly self-regulate in a way that makes more sense, and I think it admits much more open systems. So well worth a read, highly readable as usual. The other is some work that Cory's been doing on the activist side, this going back to the W3C to try to redress what is one of my most heartbreaking moments dealing with both them and Mozilla and their support of an effort to incorporate DRM basically into the heart of the web. You can search for my writings and podcasts on the Encrypted Media Extension, or EME, to learn more, or this piece actually has a pretty good background, pretty good explainer on what's going on here. Most notably, the fight that advocates for openness lost with the W3C to keep digital locks out of the core standards of the web. More importantly, this is a second round where a covenant is being proposed. If we can't get the W3C to roll back and think better of its decision to include digital rights management into core web standards for an increasingly media-rich web experience, maybe we can get them to do something similar to what they did with software patents, an issue previously that they didn't want to take a strong stance on, but they found a compromise, a sort of non-violence, non-litigation stance, a commitment that allowed them to navigate their way through that so that companies could participate, individuals could participate, and a certain measure of openness could be preserved. So at its core, it's worth reading the proposal in the article that'll be linked to in the show notes for what EFF is pushing for here. And it looks like there's some good early strong support. So expect me to follow this closely and share any new developments, hopefully news that it has been accepted and that we at least have some defense against the reach of closed proprietary systems into what should be, as I've so often said, otherwise an open, vibrant digital ecosystem. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed the program, please do tell a friend. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to record a bit of audio with your smart device and send it to the same place. Until next time, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits and you share your changes under the same license.